Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's Sunday, February 2nd, 2014, and welcome to Episode 67 of the Retro Computing Roundtable. The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting. But no matter where I go, there's one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz? But since you tuned in, you probably knew that. So, let's introduce the folks that are on that roundtable today. It's more of a square than a round table. There's four of us. Along with our irregular regulars, we have a blast from the past today. They call him the master of the raster. The oldest bright young star of comedy hailing from Atlanta, where I think it hailed last week. Please welcome, he's just the best, David Grealish.
Thank you. Very happy to be here. I just have one question, though.
Yeah.
You haven't been doing this show without me, have you? All this time? Because I thought we had an agreement about that, Earl.
No, we just kept counting up the episodes just
you
know, so we'd be numerically correct. No, definitely.
Oh, Carrington said you were using a cardboard cutout.
That's right. We have virtual David. Yes, we constructed that with an Arduino. So, also on the round table today, which is squarish due to our four vertices, we have Paul. Paul, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty well. Happy February to all.
And likewise, how's life in your neck of the woods?
It's good. It's busy. Drowning in retro projects that I'm not only getting started on. But
that's the only way to do it, right? That's my modus operandi.
Yeah. Never the finishing, just the starting.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I even had a programming teacher accuse me of that when I was in high school. My teacher, Mr. Riceboard, said, Earl, you're going to do well in the business world if you ever learn how to finish a project. And so I guess I proved him wrong because I never did learn, but I did okay, though. And Michael, we have Michael, the wonder from down under. So, Michael?
Well, good morning. It's a wonderful Monday morning here, but the Southern Hemisphere, it keeps on turning. My retro activities have been somewhat curtailed by moving into the new house, but hey, everyone's got to paint a room or five every now and again.
That's right, the move. I remember you mentioning that. That's a lot of stress. Did you come through it okay?
Still moving through all the stress. There's a lot more work than what we were anticipating, but my 8-bit bunker is nearing completion.
Nice.
And as soon as I get all the new screen doors and everything, I'll start moving in my library and all of my older machines.
Excellent. Oh, that's 8-bit bunker. I'm gonna use that one. I'm going to steal that one.
Well, I'm actually where I've got it set up is actually carved out of the sandstone underneath the house, so it really is bunker-like, and might have to do something about some extra ventilation in there, a little bit on the musty side.
But nuclear-proof, which is good.
Let's hope we don't need to test it.
Yes, indeed. Now, we're missing Carrington today. He couldn't be with us, unfortunately. We wanted him to be here, but he had a conflict, and that's a bummer, because otherwise it would have been like an RCR homecoming. But we are very happy to have David on the line, which brings me to something else I wanted to mention. We've had a couple comments from listeners who had just a wee bit of trepidation communicated to us very nicely, but I feel your pain, and I understand. And the topic is just making sure, because a lot of the folks that have
newly joined the RCR, are Apple enthusiasts, and we want to let you know that the Retro Computing Roundtable is a generalist podcast. You're not going to get heavily weighted to Apple here. No problem at all with the fact that these folks are Apple enthusiasts. In fact, I dig it, but just want to let you know the content that we cover, it's going to be general in nature, except for today. Because today is we're celebrating, along with a lot of the rest of the tech world, the 30th anniversary of the Macintosh. And part of our celebration is having David as a guest, because David wrote an article and also has some thoughts on this. So we will definitely get to that and spend some time on it. So if you're not an Apple enthusiast at all, today might not be the best episode for you. But, you know, we're still going to try and keep it light, keep it moving. We're businessmen. We're doing business. So the host topic, completely Apple unrelated, perhaps, and blatantly stolen from Max, who's one of our listeners. And thank you, Max, for writing in on this. He poses the question, does programming 8-bit computers make you a better programmer of modern systems, modern computers? And some of the subtopic thoughts here. When you're programming an older machine that has limited resources, you have to be creative, and you can't have a lot of bloatware. So in that way, perhaps it makes you a more tight programmer. Also, since the 8-bit systems are more simplistic, you can have a more detailed understanding of what's actually going on in the hardware. You're not looking down on it through five layers of abstraction. So it's very hands-on and gives you perhaps, I'm posing this, and this is, you know, open for discussion, might give you a better understanding of some of computing's first principles that then demystify some of the rest of it when you're a programmer. On the other hand, if you're learning with the BASIC and ROM, which is typical of the old machines, BASIC is infamous for spaghetti code. So you might pick up bad habits. And does learning an unstructured, flailing, like a madman language like BASIC, could that ruin you when you get into languages that have more structure and more modern-day syntactic sugar? So with that, I'm going to, you know, kind of run around the table here. David, you're our guest. Why don't you go first? What are your thoughts on this?
I don't have much input in this topic. I've never really done any programming.
Programming's not kind of your deal, is it?
No. So, I mean, I did learn BASIC, and I fooled around with it over the years. That's probably the most I've ever done. And then I did take two classes in the old days, one in COBOL and then Fortran. Yeah, and those are kind of like, at least COBOL is kind of like following a recipe, really. Mm-hmm. But so I can't speak to this, and that's fine. Move on.
Well, that's okay. I'll turn it over to Paul.
I would say, well, I guess the question is, am I a ruined programmer now? Because of course, you know, I started with BASIC and 6502 assembly and so forth. But it seems to me, I guess my thought on this is that we... the nice thing about the 8-bit programming is that you really do get results immediately. I feel in almost any environment I approach on a modern machine, there's a big startup ramp. There's mm-hmm. a lot of things you need to do to get a window open and, you know, put a menu up and do various things, which it's, if you are building something big, it's great because a lot of that stuff is already built for you if you learn how to use it. But it's not quite the same as being able to just sort of sit down and type 10 print, 10 input, your name, a string, and you know, just sort of get something to happen immediately. So for the purposes of teaching kids and starting out, that immediacy, I think, is what grabbed me, I just add a line in here and now I've got a blue, line on the screen. And mm-hmm. that's something that, I think grabbing someone at the beginning is more important than teaching them, how to use recursive subroutines, or object interactions and inheritance and things. I think that if I had been, if I had to start with Pascal or Objective-C or whatever, I think I might have just gone and done something else. You know, there needs to be the first initial part.
It's interesting you say that, because on the Raspberry Pi, which is designed for educational use, I mean, that's its purpose in life, Python seems to be the go-to language for that platform. And with the Python interpreter, when you're plugging along, you can get that kind of immediate feedback. You do something and something happens, and you don't have to go through a ballistic learning curve and a compile, link, run, swear, re-edit kind of cycle with that. I mean, it just works really fast. So, Michael, what are your thoughts? You got some thoughts on this?
Yeah, well, when I first started off in basic programming and I found the go-to statement, I basically recoiled straight away, and I hadn't even heard about structured programming back in those days. You know, I'd just left high school, starting university, and these computer things really caught my attention, and it kind of drove me into structured programming, even, you know, still with line numbers, but then... over time, I moved away to full-screen text editors as soon as they were available, and did my programming that way. But yes, I agree with Paul. The immediacy of starting up, getting in, coding, doing it, interactive debugging, that's what really got me going in programming. And I'd have to agree, if I had started off with Pascal or one of the other languages, that ramping up, I don't know where I'd be today. And most of my programming today is on Linux and AIX using Perl and various scripting languages. So I'm still pretty much a text-based programmer. I've never really moved into doing much with graphics or with a windowing environment. Everything I need to write has to be tight, efficient code within the constraints of the languages that I use. Everything basically does what it needs to do on the objects it's working on, and logging and keeping track and doing everything that's needed. But I think that the early 8-bit programming in BASIC in ROM got me started into computers, and I'll definitely go with creativity needed due to lack of abundant resources. There's not much in there, and you needed to really get those algorithms sorted out so that you could do what you needed to do, mm-hmm. add the functions that you needed, and that's just the way that I go these days. So I could say I'm still programming in the 80s. I've just upgraded the platform.
Nice. And I love both Perl and AIX, by the way. So one of these days, you and I need to have a chat offline about that stuff. So AIX, I think, is way underappreciated in terms of the UX.
Yeah, it was a bit of a culture shock, because when I started the job where I am, it's a mid-range environment, and I came from IBM Big Iron, from a ZOS background, and I was floundering for a few months, but once I got going in AIX, no looking back. So very comfortable there. It's almost, as I said, it's almost like going back to a bigger, better 8-bit environment, just a few more bits.
Nice. So since you've got the microphone, why don't you talk about some of the magazines that are still needing to be scanned? You've got a bullet point here to discuss.
Well, I was on that wonderful thing called Facebook, and it popped up a article from a while ago, and it was actually new to me. It was about the old Australian Apple Review magazine having been scanned by Andrew Rowan and Bill Martin and posted at APPLE. We'll put the links to that in the show notes. But it got me thinking, what other magazines out there haven't been scanned, aren't available, and how would I find out what is actually out there? Okay, I'm pretty much a dyed-in-the-wool Apple fanatic, but I love reading about computers in general, and especially the older magazines. I just love the older magazines. It's a style of magazine that is just not there these days. Now, to me, they have turned into product reviews and something to put ads in. But I just love these old magazines. And how can I find out more? There's archive.org, but I still find that I need to have a bit of an idea of what I'm looking for. So it was actually quite good to see an old Australian magazine scanned and made available as PDFs, and especially with the permission of the publisher of the day, which is also good because it gives you that warm and fuzzy feeling that you're not trampling over someone's previous rights and whatnot. There are other magazines that have been posted with the publisher's permission, or even by the publisher themselves. But what's out there for the rest of the world? And my other point is an Australian magazine from the 80s of interest to anyone outside of Australia?
Well, I would say absolutely for myself. I mean, what do you other guys think? I would love to learn about what computing was like in the 70s and 80s and some of the wonder years for places outside of the U.S.
Yeah, I think the what I would find interesting about this is that I'm fairly familiar with the U.S. Apple magazines, but this is an Apple magazine from Australia, which would have likely, you know, many of the same kinds of tips and interesting ideas and things in it, but that I may never have seen, but I would comprehend very easily. And these were things that, at the time, there was almost no way to I wouldn't have seen these at the time. I mean, if they were in Australia, that was very far away. Now we have the opportunity to look at what was going on in Australia, what was going on in the UK, you know, I think, at least for me, you know, the entire English-speaking world. But so I'm very interested to look at this. And I know that there are some others, some British ones. There was something with a name like Apple Orchard in Britain that I've seen some issues of around that I'm interested in looking at, too. So, I think this is it's definitely worth the time to scan them and make them available.
Yeah, and I'd be interested in seeing them. I think it makes it interesting. And I'll just mention one magazine. I lived in Germany for a couple of years, and so even though I couldn't understand most of it, I'd occasionally buy Macwelt, which is the German Macworld, and I bought a magazine called 64er, which is fun. And I found some of that online. But one of my all-time favorite old computer magazines is Info 64, which then became Info. Covering more of Amiga as that evolved. And I actually have the PDFs of every one of those, and so I'm not sure how, you know, authorized they are. And the last time I checked, they're not like on a website where you can go check them out. But that's certainly a magazine that deserves a bigger audience now from a retro viewpoint.
And a big tangent, but I know that there was a lot going on in Japan during the glory years too.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Of computing. The thing is, there's a significant language barrier there. I've studied Japanese and try to be amateurishly conversant, but there's no way I could read a computer magazine.
But it's still interesting to browse, just to look through.
It's
pictures and
to,
that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And to see the different models, the ones that you kind of scratch your head and go, wow, what's that? But yeah, so I think we're all on board, Michael, that it would be of general interest.
And of course, we've covered it in the old days on this show when I was still around. What's the one website that has a lot of magazines?
Archive.org has a lot.
Yeah, really is getting to be a great repository. And also Atari Archives.
There you go. That's the one I was looking for. Right.
Has a bunch. So, yeah. Awesome. Great topic. David, this computer, what, a Mac? What?
Yeah, who cares?
It's got one of those graphical user newfangled things, right? I hear it turned 30.
It did. It's introduction, which I guess means it turned 30. So what was that? That was January 20, I'm forgetting, was it 24th or 25th? One of the two. I think it was the 25th.
24th.
It was the 24th.
Oh, 24th. It was a Friday. So that was the 30th anniversary of the introduction of the Macintosh. You know, Steve Jobs introduced it on stage at the big shareholders meeting in 1984, outside of Apple. But there were lots and lots and lots of articles written about it. I did write one, and I'm proud to say I got it up on time.com, which is cool. It looks like it got some good eyeballs, so I'd be thrilled if anybody else would like to read it. I think my take was a little different than the majority of articles out there, which were basically like, you know, look how the Macintosh has evolved, and it shows you all the different Macs through the years, and of course covering, you know, what Steve Jobs said and how that whole original presentation went. And I cover some of that too, and I put the obligatory 1984 commercial in there and then a segment of Steve Jobs introducing it. It's really worth looking at those videos, especially if you've never seen them before. But so as far as pointing out my article, the sort of standout topic I brought up about it and bring up now is that what most people don't realize is that, and you Apple II folks will really appreciate this, mostly, is that, you know, the Macintosh almost failed. It really didn't do that well. It sold really strongly the first few months, and then it dipped dramatically. So you had your, what are they called, early adopters and some of the other, you know, some creative and rich people, perhaps, that bought it for $2,500. It's very expensive, I think, for 1984, going against the slogan, the computer for the rest of us. But it really didn't do that well, and it was really sort of almost appallingly underpowered. And then with only one disk drive, it was horrible to use. Anytime you had to copy or save something, you know, what are called disk swaps, those could go up. Like if you were to copy one diskette, I think it could go well above 20 disk swaps. Of it, ejecting the disk, put the other disk in, you know what I mean? The whole thing. Mm-hmm. And so late in 84, the 512 came out, which was a huge advance. And a lot of people don't know, too, that the Mac that Steve Jobs actually demoed with, they had actually rigged it with 512K of RAM. So he wasn't really demoing a 128K Mac. But it wouldn't really be until the Mac Plus came out and almost 2 years later. Or was it 2 years today? It's in my article, but I don't remember. That sort of the Macintosh, you know, matured enough where it was really a fully utilized, you know, a tool you could utilize. So, and then it would be with a couple other inventions, trying to keep this short, but you know, the laser writer and then PageMaker, those sort of with the Macintosh and PostScript being part of that sort of came together, creating real desktop publishing, which was far cheaper than, you know, real desktop publishing publishing equipment. That's finally was what happened to sort of start making the Macintosh become where profitable and where it was successful. But so basically the bottom line is the Apple II carried the company well until the late 1980s. It really wasn't until I think like 1987 that the Mac just barely scooted past Apple II sales, and that was barely. So still the Apple II was a huge majority of profit and sales for the company. And it, you know, and it went on to do so until, you know, 1990-91, and then it really sort of dramatically dropped off. So that's kind of it. But then the other bottom line is just the cultural impact of the Macintosh is huge. And I make the point, and it's debatable, that, you know, if you use a Mac or you use a Windows machine or you use iOS or you use Android or you use any other sort of related sort of GUIs, if you will, on devices, you're kind of using the legacy of the Macintosh.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Any comment?
some of those technologies, they did invent. Some they didn't.
Right,
some
right.
They acquired, you know. And there's this long-term. I won't say rumor. I'll say misconception that mm-hmm. Apple had lifted some of those technologies from Xerox, but they didn't.
Right, right.
They were given legitimate access to those technologies, but what they did was they packaged them in a way that was elegant, I think, and let people get a taste of that. And I completely agree that we are using the legacy of those things. Recently, even for some of the programming that I was doing, I changed the fonts that I was using to some better open source, beautiful monospaced fonts that I found on the internet. And it reminded me of Steve Jobs' laser focus, if you'll pardon the pun, on typography, and how he was so interested in making sure that that was an integrated part of the experience, because without that, it might not have done as well. If it had everything else it had, but it had ugly fonts, people might have passed it by. So, yeah, that whole package. And I also agree that the Mac Plus, that was the first Mac I had, along with the LaserWriter, at work, not at home. Couldn't afford one at home. But that really is where it found its stride. I don't think it's that unusual for a product to carry a company, right? I mean, Microsoft was banging away at Windows for years and years.
Well, DOS before that.
And letting their DOS product carry them until they could finally come out with a Windows that was worth using.
And I'll just add that a word I really like is democratization, or, you know, that the Macintosh democratized a lot of these things that we take for granted now. But really, right, all credit does not go to Apple or the Macintosh. Other companies, other, you know, Windows building on what Apple did and vice versa, and copying things from X Windows and different things, both of them, they all came to be, you know, build that to where we are now. But, you know, definitely the Apple Macintosh was just hugely impactful. And there's so many people that can tell their story, me included, how it changed their life. So, you know, it got me really excited about computers. So I foresaw a Macintosh in late 1986. And once I saw that, I'm like, I don't want anything else. This is what I want. Mm-hmm. And it was black and white. And I worked for a dealer, and we sold, you know, Apple II. I don't know, the GS had come out yet. And I liked them. And I even didn't dislike PCs. But I'm just like, this machine is what really impressed me, what you could do with it. So anyway, so read my article if you get a chance. There's a link in the show notes. So moving on, part of this too is Apple did something very interesting. They actually celebrated their own history. And Harry McCracken over at Time, what is this thing called, the Technologizer? He wrote an interesting article about that. But there's a link in the show notes to Apple's video, which I think is still up the last time I checked. I didn't check today, but you know, if you go to their apple.com and then you click on a link, you can see this video. So they did a really nice video celebrating their history at 30 years of innovation, it's called. And so that's remarkable, right? Apple never looks back.
That's what they told you, right?
Yeah.
I must admit, I actually went to the Apple website to see them not do anything for the 30th anniversary. And when I went up onto Apple.com and saw that video there and everything they did, I was shocked. I was pleasantly shocked. But I deliberately went to their website to see what they weren't doing. And they went and did something.
Very well done, too. And it's amazing in the video how much they seem to recognize. In that video, I get lost for words. Slap my face. It really demonstrates how they do get it. They were able to balance celebrating their past, celebrating all their innovation, yet showing the future and showing how they're still, you know, they see themselves as, you know, the makers of the future and innovation. And they perfectly balance those things. And these are things I argued in some of my series of articles about, you know, Apple building like a visitor center and a gallery of their history at the new campus, that you can do this, Apple. Why don't you consider it? You know, but that video perfectly demonstrates what they can do. They got it. So I don't know if they're going to do any more of that or what that means for the future. Anyway, moving along, got a few different links here. There's also a link to about a lot of the original Macintosh development team celebrated the Mac's 30th anniversary. And I guess it was either Friday or the Saturday. I think it was the Saturday after. They all got together at the original place where they, you know, the demo was done. Anybody have that on the tip of their tongue, the center? But it's in the article here at CNET, Flint Center. And Cupertino. And then there's lots of great pictures at the link. So I think, again, I'm not trying to dig through the article. I think there's probably about 75-80% of the original developers, the team, they showed up for this. It was a big deal. And so along with that, if you go to the next link here, so they did a couple different panels and talks and so on. There's actually a Kickstarter in place right now. So I'm linking over to that. And I got to tell you the truth, though, I'm not very optimistic for them because they have a very high goal of $12,800 with one third of their 30 days gone already. They're at 20 days and so they've only raised $800. And one of those people is me. So,
what is the Kickstarter for again, David?
It is basically the organizer, one of the organizers of, if not the organizer of that event, along with Jonathan Zuffi, who you guys know, it wrote the Apple book. you know, like every what's the website he does? I forget, but he has he came out with a book and has like every Apple product ever made in it.
Right, it's a website. Iconic Gund.
There you go.
The website is Shrine of Apple.
There you go. Thanks. So basically, they got together, and what you're getting for supporting this, and I imagine this is also to help pay for like that celebration and all, is you can get a T-shirt, a poster, a postcard, and then they just now have said for $75 level, you can get a DVD of all the panel discussions and interviews and that sort of stuff. So I actually went for that because I'm very interested of seeing it. But again, I'm not real optimistic they're going to raise $12,800 or another, let's just say $12,000 in the next 20 days. Maybe.
Well, maybe if some of the RCR fans are interested in that, they can head on over. We will have that link in the show notes.
I hope they do because I would like to have some of that stuff. And again, I'm a $75 of supporter. All right. So the last thing in my little discussion here is, oh, Paul, you added this. So you go ahead and take it.
Oh, well, there was just sort of contemporaneous with all of this celebration. There was a video that was found, and I'm not sure exactly who's responsible for it. I think it might be the Computer History Museum. But it was a video of the meeting of the Boston Computer Society shortly after the you know, sort of official shareholder meeting introduction of the Mac. And so it sort of replicated a lot of the stuff that was in a much poorer quality version in the original keynote, and or I don't know if it was a keynote even, but the original unveiling. And then afterwards there's a kind of like a Q&A session with a bunch of the people who were involved in the creation of the Macintosh. So it's actually really interesting. It's fairly informal. The video is good. It's really worth watching. It is about an hour long, but it is quite nice to see that showed up.
Yeah, it's actually that's him cool. Redoing the presentation.
One of the things I love about coming to the RCR is I find, you know, all kinds of things I want to go watch myself. What were you going to say, David? I'm really excited about going.
Yeah, it's very good. I was just saying it was basically, and this was just learned recently, I guess, from the release of this video, is that he essentially redid his presentation for this much more quaint, smaller group of people versus the big Flint Center one he did. So like 1 or 2 days later, right, Paul, he went and stood in front of them and did the whole thing all over again. And it's just right. Very, you know, it's nice. And, you know, he put a lot of heart and soul into it, too. Just like he was standing in front of thousands of people, he did it for, you know, a smaller group. So, and that's really it for my segment. But it's a major milestone, I think, in the history of the Mac, and it's still here. And like I say in my article, it's a small percentage of computers, you know, sales and so on. But, I'll add one more thing. Is a lot of people forget, too, that the iPhone, I do a link to one video where Steve Jobs introduced the iPhone, where he actually mentions how it was built on OS X. And so I just kind of point out how it's a legacy of the Macintosh. It's sort of like the Macintosh, you know, made into a handheld. So it's sort of a Macintosh phone, you know, is what the iPhone was originally.
Interesting point.
So ties it all together. That's it. So happy birthday, Mac.
Cool.
As I talk on mine right now.
is it the only, I mean, of course, you could say it's obviously not the same model as was introduced 30 years ago, not even remotely, but I'm trying to think what other computers there may be today that still carry the same brand name that have existed for that long. I can't think of anything.
I mean, I think the modern Mac spiritually is every bit just like the original one. Obviously, Mac OS X is built on Next Step. So, which was, you know, Steve Jobs had his hand on it, or his company, but it's not the same specific lineages as the Mac OS, I guess, or System 1 through System 7, 8, whatever, 9. I don't know, Windows, it goes back to what, 1989, I guess? No, longer than that, 85, Windows 1.0?
Yeah, but I mean, that's not a computer.
No,
I'm
no,
just
right.
thinking that in 1984, not too long after that, presentation, I could have gone out and bought something called an Apple Macintosh.
Yeah.
And today, if I want to, I can get in my car and go buy something called an Apple Macintosh. And I can't think of anything else that is like that.
But you know what, Earl? As an avid, longtime Mac person, as my preferred platform, I would almost argue that as cool as that is, and I totally agree with you, that people buying a Windows product, it's almost the same. Because then the hardware almost doesn't matter in that sense. It's more the environment you're using, you know, and that it's history and so on.
That's true. Huh. Fascinating. Well, yeah, love to even keep talking about this, but we got to move on. In the interest of time,
okay.
I will briefly mention here that Anders emailed to let me know about a exciting eBay auction that concluded with a sale price of over $16,000. It's a DEC PDP-12, one of DEC's lesser-known computer models, but these folks had one. I believe it was for local pickup only, of course. It was in New York, and yeah, I can see why they didn't want to ship this, but oh my gosh, it's in beautiful shape. It's got that... One of the color motifs that DEC used was this limish green sort of... anyway, you can see it in the photo here. And this machine has a couple of DEC tape machines and some other interfacing hardware, it looks like, and a nice little console. It was just beautiful. Anyway, I thought it was noteworthy. It had more than 20... It had actually 25 bits on it, and wound up going for a smoking $16,400. So, congratulations to whoever won that. I hope you have great shipping resources.
Here, it's right behind me. Let me turn it on a minute so you guys can hear it.
Does it make that whirring sound? When it
I would have loved to have been to go and pick that up and bring it home and put it down in the bunker. Oh, that picture, that to me. That is the image of what I grew up with, what a computer looks like, until I found the personal computer. Just big lot of blinking lights and rotating tapes.
Yeah, it looks like a scaled down of the, you know, the big IBM UNIVAC, that sort of thing that existed a decade or more earlier.
Yeah.
It is really, really nice looking. I hadn't seen the green color scheme before either. That was sort of striking. I had seen the sort of like the pink magenta, which is a little bit, I don't know. That's the pictures I've seen have all, but DEC makes really pretty stuff.
They had a unique style, didn't they? Some of their PDP-11 and their VAX stuff also. Just they had a remarkable consistency of the font, and those color schemes were bright and catchy as opposed to a lot of the beige boring stuff from other manufacturers. I must admit, it's a
very interesting computer room that it's currently in. I've never seen a computer room with a raised, polished floor, hardwood floor.
I didn't notice that before.
And the beige is on the wall, and it goes so well with the blue lounge chair in the foreground.
Yes, indeed. It's almost like this was lifted directly from the 70s. Even with the throw rug.
Well, maybe that part on the right is the TARDIS.
I can hear my wife calling my name now. She found that in their living room. And a few exclamation marks at the end of it.
I managed to sneak a PDP-11. Into the daylight basement, but I think that's probably all I would have got away with.
Yeah.
Not one of these. Paul, you had a topic that kind of went along with Michael's and David's, sort of synergistic here.
Yeah. Right. It's sort of backing up a little bit to the question of magazines and the Mac celebration. Although this wasn't really intended necessarily to be coincident with the 30th anniversary of the Mac. I had I don't know how long ago, a few months ago, wound up with what turns out to be a complete set of a magazine called ST Mac. And so what I did was I scanned it and I made that available. There's I have a link. There'll be a link in the show notes to where they are on my blog. But it was interesting because it's a magazine that I think not many people knew about. The Soft Talk name, actually, there was a magazine, a popular magazine. And in fact, I think there was some sort of deal. I think if you sent in, when you originally bought an Apple II, if you sent in your serial number, you would get some, you know, like 6 months free or something like that. So they grew a big audience starting in 1980. So that was a well-known Apple II magazine, but sort of later on, 84-ish, they branched out a bit and they made a PC version and they started in February 84, just after the Mac's introduction, this ST Mac did a little story in there about how they decided to call it ST Mac rather than SoftTalk anything because it was just too confusing. They called their PC version, I think it was SoftTalk for the IBM PC, and so whenever someone was calling to get an ad in the magazine or whatever, nobody knew what magazine they were ordering, or it just became very confusing. So they said, no more magazines called SoftTalk, we're going to call this ST Mac, which of course turned into Saint Mac, I think, probably in most people's parlance. But so it's really interesting because you see right at the very beginning, you know, the kind of the reaction of people who are using these things. And it isn't entirely positive. You know, I mean, these things, they did need more memory. They did need, you know, a lot of time swapping disks and things like that. And the other thing I thought was quite interesting about these is that it's one of the only magazines where you can find Lisa ads as well. I mean, Lisa was considered to be part of their mission, at least partly. So you know, small, obscure third-party Lisa programs you can find ads for in there. But the entire SoftTalk enterprise pretty much folded in August of 84. So all of the magazines went at that point. And so there were only 7 issues, and I had them, and so I scanned them, and they are now out. So I guess that's about it on that topic. But it was neat to come across this nearly unknown magazine. So that's it.
Very cool. And again, keeping a part of history and a legacy alive. Very well done. And it just reminds me, you could spend a lifetime, if you're interested in such things, looking at all these old vintage computer magazines between archive.org and Atari archives and the things that you've archived, Paul, and other folks. I think Mike McGinnis has archived a bunch of stuff. And
definitely.
Wow. I definitely would never be bored, because there's always some of these things to go back and look at. And Michael, something old, something new, something borrowed, and now something blue?
Oh, most definitely. We seem to be moving into the age of a lot of hardware emulation, as in a new hardware device to emulate an old hardware device. In this case, it's Steve Chamberlain's floppy EMU. And it's been upgraded, and not only is it now available in blue, it supports both the original 400 and 800K floppy disk images on an SD card, but now gives you the opportunity of having the 1.44 megabyte floppy images supported on the same device with the same connector. So you can use this on your original 128/512K Mac, and then also same device with a 1.44 floppy image onto a less old Macintosh, we might say. But I've always liked the idea that we can now have hardware devices, solid state, and it's saving us from putting a couple of extra RPMs on all those old floppy drives using the old media. And you see this, it's started a few years back for other platforms, but it's really got to the stage now with the integrated circuits that are available. And, of course, then you've got the Raspberry Pi and the Arduinos and other things that are out there doing their bit. But this hardware emulation, I think, is such a wonderful thing at the moment. And now we've got a link in here, and if anyone's looking to get a floppy emulator for their older Macintoshes. You know, in my opinion, basically the 84, 85 year of the Macintosh is as far as I'm interested in going. And this would be a great little acquisition. And if you're interested, there's even the information that you can use to create your own physical PCB, circuit layouts, everything there to do it yourself, or you can click on the Buy It Now link. Steve's got it all there, and if you go to his homepage, currently has a video of doing your own soldering surface mounted devices, and it doesn't look that hard.
I've never done any surface mount soldering.
I haven't yet either. Oh, that's right. You say solder, I say solder.
Again, having the international flavor enhances us all.
Oh, well, does matter, yeah, but I'm with you. I've only ever done the straight through work. I've never done any surface mounted, and I suppose that's another project which might just have to get started somewhere.
I got, not very long ago, I got my own, it's version 1.1 of the floppy emulator, and I haven't tried it out yet. I'm holding it right now, if that means anything, but I haven't actually plugged it into anything.
Do it!
But it looks very, very cool. It's you know, finally just to be able, because these very old Macs don't take hard drives, you know, or at least not in any easy way. They really have just the floppy, so very nice.
So could you hook something like this to a Mac Plus?
Yeah,
I believe so. It just uses the standard floppy drive connector, so you just either plug it straight in or just use an extension cable to bring it round. It can come with a LCD display, cycle through the disk images that you want to load and then select. And as far as the old Mac's concerned, you've just gone and shoved a floppy disk in there. So it's an excellent way of doing things. As I said, these hardware floppy emulators have been out for quite a few number of years for all platforms, but what's coming out these days is, it's still coming out from the home hobbyist, but it's just a much more professional package, and I believe that, you know, the reliability of these things is basically commercial.
One thing that I did, I wrote to Steve Chamberlain briefly about this, and one of the things that I definitely want to try or you know, sort of encourage him to work on or something is to see if this can be used with the Lisa, because I think they have essentially the same mechanism drive as the early Macs did, and I think that would be, and also my Lisa drive doesn't work, but I think
well,
I listened
to it. Yeah, you can get a profile, emulated profile for the Lisa, but yeah, you're right. There's, you know, been a lack of something for the floppy media.
Yeah, and it's what was I going to say? I looked into it a little bit, and the Lisa actually used a much sort of a more complicated writing scheme that saved some sort of metadata, kind of hiding between sectors and things that makes it not immediately obvious that it's going to work. But I think that's one of the things I'd like to think about or try with this.
Yeah, it saved the state of the Lisa, right? Because it had to. It had to write that information out for when it shut down.
Mm-hmm. Well, and but even just in the encoding on the individual tracks of the disk, mm-hmm. there, I think there was stuff hiding between sectors that the Mac didn't use. So
I think this would solve possibly another problem too, and the more Mac savvy people could tell me if I'm right on this, but if you have a Mac SE with a super drive, then you could somehow get stuff to swap back and forth between a PC with a 1.44 drive and the Macintosh. But if you've got a Mac that has one of the 800K drives, I don't know if that's possible, is it? The PC can't write that format.
No, I've had to use the Cryoflux to read my 400 and 800K disks on my PC, and I'm not quite sure if they've got the write capability for that back with using the Cryoflux using a modern day 3.5-inch drive. I know they've got it for other formats, but this would be a good way of doing it, because whatever Mac supports that floppy drive, this basically is an SD card-based super drive, I suppose.
Very nice. So, moving on, David, you got another Vintage Computer Festival coming up your way? That's exciting.
Yes, I just thought I would mention it. I'm not heading it up this time, so I am not the director or the producer or anything. I'm just a local who will be attending it. Hopefully I'm going to give a talk there. But, you know, I won't go into it, but I've been busy doing other things, like trying to pursue comedy and other things like that. So, but I want to mention it. So let me click over here. Just to also mention, so there's actually two VCFs coming up. There's the VCF Vintage Computer Festival East 9.1, which is April 4th through 6th. And so this is the first time there are 3 days, and that's in the New Jersey area. So check that out if that's good for you. vintage.org, or in the show notes there'll be a direct link to the Vintage Computer Festival Southeast 2.0, of which, you know, I was the director last time around, and it's exactly a month later, May 3rd and Saturday and Sunday, May 4th. So, and the information on the site is they just got it up, and then it has a lot of static information there, so there's not a whole lot of information there yet. So what is that? That's 3 months away, so they better get busy. But anyway, just to mention it, that's up and coming. So you got two of them to look forward to if those are convenient for you, or not, if you want to go.
And that Southeast one is where again?
Oh, Atlanta. Yeah, I'm sorry, where I am, the greater Atlanta area. It's actually fairly close to where I live, which is north of the city. The venue is, it's at a former CompUSA in Roswell, Georgia, and it's about 22 miles north of, you know, city center Atlanta.
So you have that same venue that you had last time. That worked out pretty well last time, right?
Yes, and so what I've been told is, again, this isn't official, but what's going to happen is, so basically this was a CompUSA that closed down some years ago. It was also a regional corporate headquarters, so it had these regional, these like corporate offices next to it, and those offices were the Apple pop-up museum. And then what was the tech, the warehouse, you know, shipping, receiving, the tech area of the CompUSA, that's actually was the venue of the VCF. And then the big floor that was the CompUSA, only a part of that was partitioned off, and that was like the concessions and the speaking area. So what they're doing is Lonnie Mims, the big collector here in the area, is he's, the Apple pop-up museum is still there. I think he needs to change the name. it's not a pop-up museum anymore. And then the middle area, see if I get this right, what's the middle area now, the smaller tech area warehouse will be like the speaking area and concessions, I guess. And then the big area will now be the whole, exhibitors and so on, as well as him creating a new big exhibit. And that's as much as I know about it.
Excellent.
So I've been a little involved, but anyway, again, I hope to speak. Got it cleared.
Very cool. Well, I just have one more news item here, that the Retro Challenge Winter Warm-Up 2014 is all done.
And you all failed.
As of a couple days ago.
Almost.
It is in the history books. And there were lots of... This thing just gets better and better over time. I don't know what you guys think, but this... every time they do this, they have more and more fantastic entries. This time, the entries included some programming on an SGI computer, another person who used Windows 95 for a month, I think exclusively, like tried to live off Windows 95 just to see what that would be like. That had to be painful. Archiving disks on a Deck Rainbow, trying to make sure those get saved away. Someone else looks like built a single board 6808 based computer so that they could demonstrate the power of the Motorola 6847 video display chip. And there's more stuff. Someone else built and almost got running, missed it by that much, a homebrew 6502 based computer. There's just so much fun stuff going on, and we will have the link in the show notes if you want to go over there and take a look at those summaries. And also, if you click on any of the links, it will take you to the blogs that people maintained when they were doing the Retro Challenge entries. It was just fun.
It's more sophisticated, yet less complicated. It's more powerful, yet less cumbersome. It can store vast amounts of yesterday, or tell you what's in store for tomorrow. It can draw a picture, or it can draw conclusions. It's a personal computer from Apple, and it's as easy to use as this. Macintosh, the computer for the rest of us.
I'm going to jump to the host's retro computing gift idea. I've got an odd one this time. Usually we have gift ideas that are whimsical, fashionable, things like that, just kind of fun. This one's a lot more utilitarian. I'm suggesting that if you're a retro enthusiast, you ought to get yourself a good... Michael, would you help me out here? I would say soldering station. Michael, are you still there?
Well, that's close. Yes, for me, I'd be ordering the FX 888D soldering station.
Nice, thank you. In any case, I think that one of these is a good tool in your tool bag, and here's why. The El Cheapo soldering iron that you're going to go to the local store, whose name I won't mention, but pick up and bring home, won't do very well for you. It will make you a messy soldering person. It will perhaps damage some of your components because it doesn't transfer the heat well enough, so you're holding the iron on the components longer, meaning that you're burning up your components while you're trying to connect them together. In all of the videos, blogs, everything that I read, people suggested you get this Hakko FX888D soldering station, and just people universally went crazy over this particular product. It's not cheap. It's in the $90 to $100 range. But especially as we move forward in retro computing, I think we're going to be repairing more and more of the items that we have because these things aren't going to last forever. One of my inspirations is Teza, Terry Stewart, down in New Zealand. If you go look at his blog, you'll find that a lot of the items that he's received needed work of some sort, and rather than trying to get somebody else to do it or just selling them off, he rolls up his sleeves and starts repairing these things. If you're going to do that, you need to have the right tools. So I bought one of these for myself and found that I really love it. It heats up fast, does a good job at what it does. So again, it's not exciting. It's not something like you go, oh, wow, look how blinky that is. It is kind of cool, though, that it has a digital readout, and it tells you what the temperature of the soldering tip is. And so,
like anything, if you're serious about it, though, it's not that expensive. I mean,
no, it's not a bank breaker, is it? But
I'd say that it's a very good selection of a retro gift.
It's a wallet breaker, not a bank breaker.
The soldering station I bought doesn't look anywhere near as fancy as this one, but it's definitely what you need if you want to get in there and fix what you've got and do other little repairs, and you're up to the job. This is an essential piece of equipment, and I just wish mine looked as nice.
Yeah, I think I might wind up getting one of these. I've been trying to make do with the unnamed store's, slightly higher end cheap one.
Yeah, it's just the hot stick. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I did want to mention that the link that you're using, though, it shows that they're out of stock, but I'm sure you can get it other places. They do show it on Amazon as being available. But if you don't like Amazon, there's other places I know.
So I think that the link that I used was SparkFun, wasn't it? You can also pick these up at Adafruit. You could pick them up on Amazon. One of the things to watch for, if you go to eBay, these have become so popular that there are clones. And you want to watch out for that because you might get something that you think is an authentic Hakko soldering station, but find out that it isn't, actually. And that would be quite a disappointment. So that's my retro computing gift. And I'll just also point out that one of the other folks who recommended this particular thing and has some great videos on how to solder, there is a blog called the Electronics Engineering Video Blog by a fellow down under named Dave Jones. He just does a great job. His videos are very entertaining. I don't know if you guys have ever seen any of his videos, but he has a great video blog on electronics, gadgets, and teardowns, and this kind of thing. And he's got a series of three videos on how to properly solder, and I think that they're invaluable because that way, again, you won't be breaking your stuff.
Right. Yeah, he had... I think we may have mentioned it last time, but he was the one, I think, who did the teardown of the Sinclair C5, the little motor car.
Oh, yes. I think I did see that on his video blog. He also had a teardown of an old IBM, one of those gigantic hard drives. And it was fascinating to see what was inside there. Of course, it was heartbreaking to see him rip it apart, but it was probably broken anyhow. But let's go buy some stuff. Paul, what have you got for us on eBay? What should we buy?
Well, there were a couple of things that I was going to mention. Let me start, though, with the one that isn't exclusively Apple. actually, neither of these are. But so there's been some discussion. There's an auction. I'm not even sure that this is going to be posted before, like if the podcast will be out before the auction is over. But it's for something called a Mimic Spartan computer, which is it's basically a peripheral for the Commodore 64, which is an Apple II. So what it allows you to do is basically the idea is that you can you get all of the power of the 64 as well as all the power of the Apple II, and what it effectively is an Apple II minus a keyboard and a disk drive that you sort of like connect to the back of your Commodore 64, using the Commodore 64 ultimately as the keyboard for the Apple II if you are in Apple II mode. But it's an interesting and strange thing. It's a weird looking, it's nice to look at the pictures, as well. So, anyway, right now it's currently at $168, but I suspect this is unusual enough that I suspect that this is going to wind up going for a fair amount more. And then the other sort of, as I was looking around for just sort of miscellaneous strange things to mention on eBay, there is something called the PQ, the Party Quiz game. This is for the Apple II, and I found it's a wrapped box, and what it is basically four controllers that each have four buttons on them, and the idea is that you sit around with your family or friends and play quiz games using your Apple II. And I think this particular one, I believe, is only for the Apple II, but they did make similar ones that worked at least, I think, with Atari and Commodore 64. It's just a weird thing. And in fact, actually, I've seen a couple online recently. So this is the only one that's still listed at the moment. It's a buy it now, so it will go whenever it goes. But it's pretty cheap, actually. It's $22. But those are my picks.
Excellent. I'm not going to do that party quiz game in any incarnation because my son does gaming and he's got lightning reflexes. Uh-huh. I'm not going to try and compete with him on that hit the buzzer first sort of thing. But those are great. Michael, you mentioned something that if you've got a dollar, what is it?
Well, if you've got a dollar to spare, why not get some Dilbit? Get yourself a little bit of Dilbit. What this is the first compilation, Always Postpone Meetings with Time-Wasting Morons. Now, that title really resonates with me this morning because I'm back at work and first day back from several weeks off. There is invariably the couple of hundred emails that haven't been read and all the meetings where people are wanting to partake of my knowledge and expertise. And I saw this as I was just cruising through, and I think I could categorize a good two-thirds of my meetings as ones that I would wish to postpone. But the important thing is this compilation includes the first Dilbit strip from April 16, 1989.
Wow.
And goes through to October 1989. So Dilbit's been around, and the poor chap still doesn't seem to have really progressed far in the company. But at least he's still got a job.
I didn't know he went back that far.
No.
He doesn't look like he's aged a day.
No. But link that I've currently got here, it's on eBay from Goodwill Bookworks. For 99 cents, buy it now. And for me, only an extra $15.99 shipping to Australia.
Oh my goodness.
I think I might go looking for it local. But for anyone who's closer, there you are. Buy it now, 99 cents. Go on. I dare you to hit the hammer on this one.
I think the second this show is posted, it'll be purchased. Unless I bought it first.
There's a few of them around, so anyone just have a bit of a scan for that name on eBay. I'm sure you'll pick one up. There are ones for slightly more than 99 cents, but I've got this one. Otherwise, I'd be tempted to grab it myself.
So, David, how do you follow that? How do you beat Dilbert? What have you got for us?
Well, I went with I figured I might as well list a Mac, an old Mac.
A Mac.
So along with the reason I'm here and the topic at hand, or my showing up again, is I did searches for Mac and then Macintosh and vintage computing and just computers and mainframes. There's a lot of them out there and on eBay right now, and they're really expensive. So people are definitely charging a premium.
Included,
go ahead.
Yeah, you should have included the keywords of Steve Jobs and Rare.
Yeah. Yeah, so people are pulling a nice premium on some of this stuff, but I found one, I think, so far anyway. It's got 20 bids on it at $66. Is a pretty good deal. It's a Mac Plus with an ImageWriter 2, 800K, the external disk drive, more, it says, in the boxes. So it'll be interesting to see what this does. I'll tell you what's more interesting about it is, so it's in Illinois, Lake Zurich, Illinois, and I'm in Atlanta, Georgia, so that's not too far from here, but it's only showing $22 standard shipping. That seems really cheap. So I don't know if this person's underestimated the weight of all this stuff, because an ImageWriter 2 in the box, that's pretty heavy by itself.
Ooh.
And
yeah.
Then
not quite as heavy as the old ImageWriter 1, but yeah, that's
yeah. Well,
and
then the Mac Plus
weight to ship.
But here's the other thing: if you look in the description, the ImageWriter 2 also includes a ThunderScanner image scanner, and I really would have sold that by itself, because I think potentially you could have gotten more money for it, separately as an item. But if it might stay real cheap, and this would be a great starter vintage Mac, for not a lot of money, maybe in the boxes.
It's got a day and 17 hours left
as of right now,
and the current bid of $66, I think, is amazingly underestimated for this. This is beautiful.
It looks pretty clean. It's even got the original Kensington little trackball. You see that?
Yeah,
it's kind of yellow on one side, but.
Well, there's a little yellowing on this, but if you notice from the pictures, this is a functional Macintosh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of the things that I love when people are selling a computer is that they show you that it works.
Right.
That they've taken the time to test it. I think this is, wow, this is great. Mm. I got to go for a couple of minutes, guys. There's an eBay bid that I need to place.
Actually, if you read the listing on this one, and I don't know if this is legitimate to do, but it does say essentially winning bidder will pay actual shipping costs. It's going to be a lot, but it's not determined until the choice is made as to what it is. So I'm not sure what that means. It seems to me like if you really wanted to stick it to the buyer, you could say, well, you listed it as $26 shipping. But
The other thing too is eBay actually makes money on however much you end up charging shipping. So maybe that's why the person made it real low. Because then they're on the back end, they're going to charge them and get around the extra fees.
I wonder if that's also what's scaring some folks off. Because in this condition and with all this equipment, I would think this would be going for a lot more. But if people are uncertain, thinking maybe they'll have to pay $150 in shipping, they might hesitate to make a bid. Huh.
Yeah.
Good catch, Paul.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I have a little something that I thought looked fun. A couple of what are called 1802 membership cards. So you guys remember that a long time ago there was a single board computer, the RCA Cosmac, and then a hobbyist / business, I had the chance to interview him on Retrobits, Spare Time Gizmos, has made a few reproductions, including the Cosmac Elf. And this looks like a small, almost credit card sized reproduction or function, work alike of the Elf. They just look so cute. And it's an actual functional little computer trainer emulator.
It's like in a tin, like an Altoids tin or something, maybe?
It's kind of what it looks like. It looks like about that size. And it connects up to your PC with the parallel port, and you can program it with those toggle switches, just like an Altair or the Cosmac, things like that. And, oh my gosh, what a fun little – so the seller is selling two of them, and the bid right now is $76 with two bids. Shipping's very reasonable because these are small. And I don't know what this will ultimately go for. There's almost 4 days left on this particular thing. But it got me interested. I hadn't heard of these 1802 membership cards before. So I went doing a little research and found out it looks like you can still get these. And so I'm going to do a little bit more research on it, maybe even try and have an email conversation with the person who put this project together. But I was sad in the past that the Cosmac Elf from Spare Time Gizmos wasn't available anymore because it looked like a lot of fun. If you could get one of these, wouldn't that be cool? Like get one of these and build it and have a brand new little SBC based on the 1802?
It's what you'd call a work-alike versus a replica, right? Or a...
I believe so.
Yeah.
And it looks like it's. I think it's a fairly intense project, but I have looked at this not too long ago, and it's very interesting. It would be very interesting to build.
Do you think it's more than, for instance, one of the Kim replicas from Briel Computers? Or the replica one or something like that? Do you feel like one of these would be more work to build? I mean, I'm looking at the components, and it looks roughly comparable.
I think it's I'm looking at the boards, and I think the thing is that it's a very small space. The replica one is not quite as tight as this. You know, there's a lot of stuff to do in a small space on this, and it looks like there are more connections to make. It's probably sort of comparable. I didn't build the Kim. David, you built the Kim one replica, right?
Yeah, from Briel. Vince Briel. Yes, I did.
So it's
barely.
it looks like it's, you know, it's in the same ballpark. This is one of the things that I've hoped to build at some point, although I have a stack of things to build that is increasing much faster than my time.
And I found the page where the person that made this, so it's Lee Hart.
That was what I came up with. It's still available, right?
Yeah. Well, it looks like it says status is from last May, that some boards are still available. So you have to or kit as above. Yeah, so I don't know if you can get everything from them, but yeah, apparently you can get these other than just the one on eBay.
Yeah, fascinating. And Paul, you also had one of the replica 110s, right? But you didn't build it. That came assembled.
No, I built it. If you look at the picture, you know, there's a couple of kind of goofy angled resistors in there and things. That was actually not too hard to build. I think it took me, I forgot, I wrote it down at some point, but it was a few hours, you know, pretty much from just with all the parts laid out to the thing giving me a prompt.
So I gave up building things. That's why, you know, the one machine I have here in my office I'm keeping is my Altair 8800 replica, which I bought it built. Because there's no way I'm going to be able to build that thing. Even though inside it's nothing like an original one, but still.
What number is yours, Paul?
Oh, P4 or something like that. I think it was a review board.
Oh, I see. So
it doesn't even count.
Not one of the numbered 50s. Wow, it's even more rare. That's the way you could say. Nice. Well, let's get to the closing discussions, because I think Michael's on a little bit of a time constraint here, and also folks might understand we are recording this on Super Bowl Sunday. So for those of us in North America, you know, just look at the commitment of your RCR team. I mean, Michael's probably saying football. That's not football.
It's also Groundhog Day.
It is, isn't it?
I look forward to Super Bowl. I love the ads.
Ah, yes, that's right. The Super Bowl ads. Well, you can always catch those on YouTube after, though.
Mm.
But I'm not a football fan myself, but I usually use this day of the year as my homage to manlyhood and sit around and try and eat some useless snack like nachos and watch football on the big screen. And I make, you know, lots of grunting sounds like, oh, 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 you know, that kind of thing. And that does me for the year, basically. But yeah, closing discussions. We'll start around the table here with Michael. It's kind of sounds sad.
Yes, my retro challenge basically got trumped by my retro renovation. So big hint for anyone going to the retro challenge, don't buy a house at the same time. You will find so many things to do, and if you can't find enough things to do, your wife will.
Right.
So yeah, I'm going to try and finish my my retro challenge for getting my structured basic preprocessor going, because I don't really want to recycle that challenge for the next time around for the big deal in June, I believe. I've already got some other ideas for that, so I'm going to try and finish it off in my own time. But the cleaning, the fixing, and the painting of the new house, it won hands down. Everything's looking good, but retro challenge, winter warm-up, sorry, did not complete.
As much as I love the retro challenge, I think your priorities were in the right place.
Oh, I'm still alive.
That proves it.
Paul, what about you?
My story is very much the same. I did have a hope of doing the retro challenge winter warm-up. I have this, I think I mentioned it before, a fairly nice set of these little IXO peripherals to a little IXO terminal, and I wanted to try to get it working. And as it turns out, both times of year for the retro challenge are terrible for me. So the winter warm-ups through in January, and I never have more than the last couple weeks available, and the main ones in July, and you know, a bunch of that's taken up with Kansas Fest. So I think I may look into time shifting this next time, and you know, sort of secretly do it in November, and then just release details in January. But
you're going to DVR it, as it were.
Exactly.
And you're in the academic world,
right? So in principle, it would seem like there would be time in the summer and then time in the sort of between semester breaks, but no.
real life. Always getting in the way. David, what's your story? David, I got to say, it was really fun having you join us on the podcast today. I miss you, man.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on, because I really enjoyed it. Yeah, it's been a while, and I miss it. But so what I've been doing is I've actually taken a couple of comedy, sketch comedy is what I'm into versus stand-up. I'm not trying to be a stand-up comedian. So I've taken an introductory to sketch comedy acting and writing, and I'm waiting to start another intermediate acting class in a couple of months. But I've been on stage now, and I joined a little comedy troupe. I'm just doing some bit parts, but I wrote a couple of sketches, and I was actually in one of the ones I wrote, and my other one got performed, so that was all really exciting. Yeah, so I'm moving forward with that and just other projects, writing projects. But it was great to recently write like the Mac article and, you know, be back on the show, because again, I haven't done anything computer history related in a while. So, you know, I'm not giving up on it totally. It's still in my blood. Another thing I mentioned, I put the link in the show notes, just my website, classiccomputing.com, because I would like to point out, you know, there's a lot of material there that I built up over the years, and so go read it if you never have. One of the things I want to point out is, well, I wrote a book, you know, a couple of years ago, and the PDF version's available for only $3.99. I think it's a pretty good deal. But back to what I was talking about, like Apple celebrating their past, you know, I wrote a whole series of articles about how I believe Apple should do that sort of thing, and specifically how they ought to build a visitor center and a gallery of their history. I didn't call it a museum. I did it first, and I felt like that's a bad word. Don't call it that. But I've been keeping that up a little bit. I haven't written anything new, just posting other articles like Harry McCracken's articles there. And I invite anyone to check those things out. And also I have a link about in my main site about all the interviews I've done, like with John Scully and Ed Roberts years ago. Excuse me, I did a written interview with Alan Kay from Xerox PARC. That's pretty cool. And, you know, and a couple other people. That's pretty interesting. So I invite you, check out what I've done.
And would you make sure to get a link in the show notes here, because I don't see it, for where people can get the PDF version of your book? Because I think if people haven't read that,
oh, okay,
for $4, they should stop what they're doing. Stop the podcast right now. and go buy that yeah. book and read it because it's really fun.
Well, it's as soon as you go to my site, there's mm-hmm. a link up there that says book. But either one you want to
look. ClassicComputing.com?
Yeah, actually, I'll change it to the book link. Why not?
Okay.
Because I want to sell them.
Yeah, well, you want to sell them, people should read them, I think.
You've probably got boxes and boxes of those PDFs cluttering up your house.
Yeah. Actually, just to mention it, what's interesting is, so I have no more printed ones, which is, you know, nice. Amazon, I went there just yesterday, and they're all gone from there, so that's kind of cool. There are a few printed copies left, though. They're from, and the link is on my site of where you can go. So I actually have a small distributor in the Portland area. Earl?
Really?
I haven't told you that, yeah. Cool. And they're actually selling some of my printed zines, the ones that are left, and I've probably had 10 left or so, 9, and so they're selling them for me.
Very nice.
Yep. But thanks again for having me on.
Yeah, it was our pleasure. So on my side, I have to apologize to you guys because my retro challenge actually went pretty good this time around.
Boo!
But, however...
We are not worthy...
For years, though, it's really not fair, though, because for years I've been banging away at this try to do a vintage virtual floppy drive for the PX8 notebook computer. And with the Raspberry Pi and this Pi Face add-on that gives it an LCD display and some buttons, it was the perfect platform to sit down and start hacking out some Python to do this. And I had a lot of fun. And now that it's done, I think I'm actually going to try and make it a package that people can get if they want to do it. I won't be selling it, but I'll have the bill of materials and where you can buy the stuff and also the instructions on how to build the cable, because that's the only tricky part is doing the mini DIN 8 to the DB9 serial cable that you need for this. But Paul, I think you've got a PX8 and mm-hmm. That outfit in Colorado had them new in box for a long time, and a lot of them went out there, but you can't get the PF10s anymore. People who have those are pretty darn lucky because they were rare even way back when. So, I really had fun with that. The other thing is a little spoiler. Tomorrow night I'm interviewing Evan Koblenz regarding the VCF East for Retrobits. So okay. That should kick out on the Retrobits pretty soon, and you guys can get a preview of what's coming up at VCF East. Sounds like they got some exciting stuff getting ready to go there, as they always do.
Do you think you want to interview Brad, the director for this one?
For the VCF Southwest?
Yeah, Southeast.
Somewhere in the South. I would love to.
Oh, David. Okay. I'll put you guys in touch.
Yeah, you think you could hook that up? That'd be awesome.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we could have, you know, the little VCF previews coming here. It's exciting for everybody. Awesome. And so that's what's going on in my neck of the woods. And with that, I believe we're done. Thank you, Michael, Paul, David. It's lovely to talk to you guys as always.
Thanks, man.
Yep, thanks.
And that's it for this show.
Bye, everybody.
Yeah, and thanks for being with us today, Michael, even though you had to juggle some stuff to do it. I appreciate that. You can find the show notes for all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us, or you can be disgusted with us in the forums at vintage-computer.com/VCforum. And vintage-computer.com, I always plug that because it's such a great forum for people involved in retro computing. You follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast, and you can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We always love hearing from you, and sometimes we just summarily steal the stuff that you send to us and discuss it in the show.
Thanks, Max.
Max, appreciate that. We're a proud member of the Throwback Network. Mr. Flack himself runs that network over at throwbacknetwork.net. Lots of great podcasts for all things retro, not just computing. And if you like us, please write a review on iTunes. It helps get the word out. And until next time,
retro compute. Synchronization is out.
Yeah. It can be fixed in post.
Bye.
Bye.